Talk given Sunday, 6th July, 1975. It is essential for all of us who care for the religious life, which means the truly human life, to ask ourselves, what is it that we really care for? It is so easy to imagine that we really care for the religious life. But if we look deeply into ourselves, if we remain mindful constantly, we will discover a frightening amount of evidence pouring out every day in our lives to show that it is not the religious life that we really care for, but it is ourselves. We care for ourselves in the name of the religious life. It is because it is a retreat from the difficulties and troubles of the world. It is a compensation for our frustrations. It is at the back of our minds for the sake of realizing a happiness and peace which we always longed for. The intellect may say, oh, but I do care for the deep realities. I do have a fervent aspiration for serving God, my fellow man, and so on. But that is by self-identification, usually. It is not a selfless motivation. And this is what makes the difference between that which is truly religious and that which is, on the other hand, pseudo-religious or outrightly worldly. As long as the self is involved, something for me, we cannot honestly say that it is purely religious, which again, let me repeat, means truly human. Again and again we have talked about the meaning of the word human. I won't keep on repeating it so often. Now, because the word human has this profound and tremendous significance, a significance which is no less than transcendence itself, it is because of that that the meaning of truly religious living is such a tremendous meaning. All this naturally tends to make one depressed. Oh, but then I simply cannot attain such things. Note what we say. I cannot attain. I and attain. You see our response? It's self-oriented, isn't it? Now, I mention this because it is just one piece of evidence out of 1,000 pieces of evidence to show that our entire functioning, 24 hours of the day, is a self-concerned, self-interested functioning. We cannot get away from this bondage to the self. No one can get away from the self as such, because you, the living person, are there. And you are a self-conscious person who knows that you are you and has to live as you, as yourself, in society, in the world. So no one can get away from the fact of self. But to be self-oriented makes all the difference between being the true human and the not yet true human, the subhuman. Now, you know, it is important, it really is extremely important to see this with complete clarity. We all have more than one blind spot with respect to ourselves. You see, more than one blind spot. And it's very difficult to see this thing with complete clarity. So now, what we really care for is ourselves. We can take that for granted to start with. Our task is to release ourselves from that bondage to selfness. As I said a few moments ago, the self is there. And the self manifests in the world all through the 24 hours in terms of selfness. And it is this which is the root source of the individual's sorrow and misery and state of ignorance and non-truly human living. When one has seen, absolutely clearly seen into this selfness, and the selfness has dissolved away altogether, the self in its purity is the indispensable living vehicle of transcendence itself. And thereby it comes to true fruition as a human being, fulfilling the purposes of transcendence, the purposes of life, fulfilling the real evolutionary process. Otherwise, we do not serve the purpose for which we came into existence. You all know this, actually. But I say you and I, we all know this, actually. But it needs repetition. It needs constantly a constant lighting up in order that we may be fully awake to the fact. It is when we are not fully awake to the fact that we make our mistakes, we slip. So now, what are the signs by which we can distinguish between living, which is a self-centered living, self-oriented, and living in a manner that is unself-oriented? And in fact, it has no fixed orientation whatsoever. The The conventional reply of the man who is taught to be religious is, oh, you live unto God, you live unto the truth, you live unto whatever the ideal may be. But that is just a little piece of self-delusion, that is all. None of us can live unto the transcendent, live unto God or truth or whatever you like to call it, unless we see clearly inside ourselves that which obstructs our living unto transcendence. When we see that completely, it means that these obstructions in ourselves, these defilements of the mind, these impurities of our conduct in everyday life are completely out. It's a titanic task. And it must be borne in mind that it never ends. It never ends. You know why? Consider our bodily living. Every day we perspire. The body gets a little bit dirty. The clothes collect dust and so forth. And we have to cleanse all that, haven't we? We have a bath, we wash, etc., etc. But having done that once, it doesn't stay put like that for the rest of our life. It just happens continuously. Why? Because this is the nature of the living process. It's something which happens continuously. Now it's the same with the soul, the mind, the heart, say what you like, you see, with our very consciousness itself. It's always collecting psychical dust. It's always getting caught up in the fog and the storm and so forth of the psychical atmosphere. Whether it comes from outside or whether we generate it from within ourselves by our reactions to people, to circumstance, to the stimuli. So we constantly have to wash our souls. All right? So it is a task that never ends. We have to be mindful constantly, right to the end of our days. So you see, the way our minds all over the world, the way our minds have been conditioned to believe that, oh, we strive, practice, attain, and then we can rest on our laurels, is an absolutely untrue thing. The usual absurd pictures, you know, playing golden harps upstairs after the funeral is over and so on, sheer nonsense and stupidity of the worst sort. So is the contrary, stoking fires downstairs. That too is complete and utter absurdity. There's no such thing. Nor is there anything like attaining or realizing a nirvana or a kingdom of heaven where all you've got to do is to draw your heavenly pension from the bank of providence, you see, and all is just pure pleasure and happiness. If you had just 1 week of it, you'd be so bored that you will desperately commit some crime which will get you kicked out of heaven. Now you see, we have to be intelligent about this. Really intelligent. But the importance of what I have said somewhat flippantly is just this. That deep down in our subconscious there is this element. this tendency to weariness. Oh, I'd just like to rest now. Put my feet up on the mantelpiece and rest. But all right, how long will you rest? Only so long as it takes time to recharge you with life energy. And then you're once again out and active and nervous and making more trouble. Isn't that so? Isn't that the way of life? Now this applies very, very much in all seriousness to the deepest things that concern our life. Namely, so living that the trends of life, the big main trends, which are concerned with coming to fruition in human terms through us individual, can get fulfilled. That is the purpose of our existence. We have to try and sense that. We must not make clear-cut pictures of it. That is one of the worst mistakes we can make. But sense the trend of it and go with that tide of eternal life. Swim with it. This is our task. Now, we saw that the implication of this is that we have to become fully aware of the obstructions. Fully aware of the obstructions. What are these obstructions? These defilements, as they are called. If you look at one of the early discourses of the middle length discourses of the Buddha, you will find rather a long list. Just a minute, I must find it. Here it is. The Buddha says, "And what, monks, are the defilements of the mind? Greed and covetousness, malevolence, anger, hypocrisy, spite, envy, stinginess, deceit, treachery, obstinacy, impetuosity, arrogance, pride, conceit, indolence." There's enough to get on with for the next 20 years, isn't there? Trying to look into all that and being mindful of the manifestation from moment to moment of any one or more of these defilements as they crop up every day of our lives. Why is it so important to become fully mindful and awake to this, to any one of these defilements, every one of them, as they rise up in our minds? We tend sometimes to say, let us look at it positively. Let us look at it in terms of love and helpfulness and all the rest of it. But can I love whilst any one of these defilements is there? Doesn't it spoil love? ask the next question. Can I develop love? Acquire lovingness? I can't. I have these defilements in me. That I know from actual experience. But love in its reality, I do not know, howsoever much I may pretend that I know it. We all feel that we love somebody very intensely, very deeply. Watch that feeling carefully. Not critically, not trying to find fault with it, but just watch. Look at it and see whether it truly is love. If you find that you can define it, then there is something wrong. It isn't pure love. Why? Because that which we call love in the religious context, which is the context of the transcendent, is beyond definition. What we understand and name love is the opposite of hate, anger, malice, and so forth. It is only a shadowy dual of the love-hate complex. It isn't a reality. If it was the reality, it could never be hurt, it could never be spoilt, it would be there always, completely and absolutely, unconditionally there, transcendentally there. So it's no good my saying, oh, let me go about the world being loving. You know how one of the latest slogans or shibboleths or whatever you like to call it, which has been flaunted about by certain groups of people in the world, make love, not war. Really, they are less than half-witted, those people. Can you make that which is transcendentally and eternally there? What do you mean by making love? All that it helps to do is to increase the world population, probably. And so you see, this is an indirect way of sowing the seeds of war. No, you see, we human beings are gloriously foolish, extraordinarily foolish. So, you cannot approach it in what is miscalled the positive way. This thing which is the transcendental reality is of the eternal, unborn, undying, and also not growing, not changing, that means. Stuff of your being, and it is unknown by oneself. I do not know the stuff of my being, the ultimate absolute stuff of my being. I can give it the name love. I can equally well give it the name wisdom, truth, goodness, beauty, and so forth. Now, if we understand this, we will see that our task is really what the world is usually, out of its ignorance, pleased to call the negative way. Namely, becoming free of that which obstructs. Because this we actually know in our ordinary, everyday, dualistic consciousness, in terms of vijnana, discriminative consciousness, which says, oh, this is love, this is hate. You see? The so-called positive, the so-called reality, is something which cannot be defined. It is the unknown. And it will always remain the unknowable by discriminative consciousness, vijnana, which is confined to the functioning of the senses, the sense impressions which we receive, and their synthesis by our speech faculty. Our power of speech takes hold of these sense impressions and makes patterns of thought, belief, ideas, concepts, and all the rest of it. And so long as we are confined within this dualistic realm, the realm of mortality, well, there is always conflict. So, whilst we are confined in this realm, the unknown, the transcendent unknown, always remains the unknowable. You may say then, how does one come to know the transcendent? You never can know the transcendent, in this sense of the term knowing. But you can be transcendence itself, if all the obstructions within oneself are removed. If the mind and the heart are utterly clean, utterly empty, void in the great sense of the term, the profound sense, then through the living psychophysical organism, transcendence pours into the living psychophysical organism. Transcendence pours itself and it flows out freely without being obstructed by me, the organism. It's not easy to see this. One may catch hold of the words and one may get ideas. That will happen inevitably. Don't cling to the picture that comes up in your mind, because that picture will formulate itself this way. You watch how the mind works. I shall cleanse myself and become the vehicle of transcendence. As long as you are conscious that I shall cleanse myself and become the vehicle of transcendence, you have asserted and emphasized the separation between the I and transcendence. Therefore, it isn't there. Once we begin to see this, then we also begin to see the tremendous meaning of what is called the void, the emptiness, the shunyata, as presented in Buddhism, also in Hinduism, also in the original teachings of the Kabbalah, which are the root of the whole of the Judeo-Christian tradition. The void, the emptiness. That void, that emptiness, implies the utter cleansing of the psychophysical organism. All day and every day we are conscious of the psychophysical organism in personalistic terms. My body, my mind. But if the practice of mindfulness is of the right sort, if it is perfect mindfulness, the possessive my in the my body, my mind, vanishes completely out of consciousness. Have you ever experienced this sort of thing? That you have become completely free of the sense of personal possession over the body, over the mind. When in the waking state that happens, you are completely free and completely pure in all your bodily action. And when that happens with respect to what we commonly call the mind, which is inextricably interlinked with the body, then the all mind, the universal mind, in its transcendent purity functions through you. Don't ask, how do I know that it is done? Don't want to know. The wanting to know is the very devil. What you have to discover and be able to say in the words, I know, is just this. I know that I do not know. Because when you're in that state, the obstructive, limited selfness of oneself is completely out. And then this all mind, this transcendent mind, knows. It alone knows. I never know. And that kind of knowing can manifest through the living organism, oneself. And it manifests by virtue of being, itself being, that which the transcendent mind manifests. You see, this is really difficult, isn't it? It sounds so vague, one feels there's nothing I can bite into and get hold of. Precisely. Have you ever tried biting into God and getting hold of God? Take my advice, don't waste your energy. Go to the theater or concert hall and enjoy some good play or some beautiful symphony instead. It'll be doing something much more sensible. You can't bite into transcendence and get hold of transcendence. If you could, it is no longer transcendent. But that which you cannot get hold of, which you cannot possess, is the total and absolute reality. Whatever you think you can get hold of and possess, or I can possess, is my delusion. The mind, the brain will naturally ask, but then, what is the meaning of all this developmental process? Is there any worth at the end of it all? I mentioned this. It's a question everybody asks. But the very question shows the immaturity, the complete immaturity of the mind. How can I, the finite mortal, ask the infinite immortal to give me a piece of evidence as to the worthwhileness of its own infinity and immortality? What nonsense. I can't ask such a stupid question. It only betrays the fact that I'm ignorant. I'm blind. Does it not? You see how the intellect constantly defeats us. Where the deeps of the religious life are concerned. This intellect is the slave of our desires, of our blind animal drives. And that is why intellect has so tragically betrayed us through hundreds of thousands of years now. The brain has developed out of all proportion to other aspects of our being. But it is good that the brain asks these questions, because it wakes us up, or at least it should wake us up. If we seriously try to respond rightly to this challenge, this stimulus brought into being by this brain activity, then we may begin to see light. To see light not as another set of thoughts or ideas, because the whole lot of them are not of much use. If there is any use for them, it's a very temporary use. And this is what we forget. All of them have a temporary use. There's no doubt about that. The very fact that they came into that they spring into existence in the moment means that they are the result of some forces, life forces, acting within us. All right. They arise, see them for what they are, and don't hold on to them. Let them go. They will go of their own accord when their whole energy has fully expended itself. You know how the Buddha teaches unequivocally is shape permanent or impermanent? Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Are thoughts, ideas, concepts permanent or impermanent? Are systematized thought, philosophies, doctrines, dogmas and all the rest, are they permanent or impermanent? Is discriminative consciousness itself permanent or impermanent? He asks that question. And the answer in every case, of course, it is impermanent. Then, with right wisdom, with true insight, say, this is not the ultimate reality. Do not grasp it. Let it go. You see, this is how the mind begins to get free, by not grasping at the ideas, the doctrines and so forth, not holding on to them. That which the ideas are supposed to represent, and the ideas are just like the clothes you wear, they are not your living body. They are dead things, relatively dead things, aren't they, compared to your living body. These ideas are like the clothes that the mind wears. And the mind is the one universal mind. There is no such thing as my mind or your mind. These are illusions. The passing mental and emotional processes, the intellectual processes, the feeling processes that just go on in the living organism is what we conveniently term my mind. But it's a misnomer. It's not my in any case. We call them mental phenomena and we say this is mind, you see. So don't grasp at all these external changing things. Observe them as they arise and see whether they represent any defilement or any defiled state. And when you see very clearly that it is a defilement, it's an illusion, a delusion. It is impetuous, it is stingy, it is deceitful, it is treacherous, and so on and so on. It is envious, it is jealous. When you see all that, you just let it go. You will see also the opposite duals when they arise. Is it kind? Is it generous? And so on. You see? Don't hold on to it. Because if you hold on to this kindness, which is after all a small expression, just as any defilement is also a small expression, if you just hold on to that kindness, the divine kindness, the universal, the infinite generosity and charity and so forth, cannot come into being. Because we are holding on to the little thing. We insist upon taking just a tiny little wine glass to life eternal and say, oh, please fill this up. And then we say, ah, I got a wine glass full of life eternal. Have no wine glass, and life eternal will continuously pour itself into you. You'll be swimming in it forever and ever. So don't grasp at the ideas, at the concepts. When their energy is expended, it means that you have learned from them what there is to learn. Then you just let it transform itself. It will transform itself. And in this process, there will be nothing left in the mind which is unworked out. This is a very important point. You see, this whole heap of the unconscious, in Western psychology, Jung has talked of the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious and so forth. We have talked in India 30 centuries before that, 35 centuries before Jung, about the vasanas, you see. And they represent just this personal and collective unconscious. What are these vasanas? The unworked out mental impressions. They sink into this great well, so to say, of the mind. Because the mind is immeasurable, it is endless. They sink down there, which means simply that they are no longer in the forefront of our conscious attention. We are no longer immediately conscious of them. So there is this vast collection of unworked out mental impressions. Now, these unworked out mental impressions become transformed. This energy becomes transformed. It is as if the whole being becomes lighted up, purified mentally. And that is the state of freedom. That empty state is the state of knowledge in the religious context. Funny thing to say, isn't it? When all the heap of unworked out mental impressions, when all the ideas and concepts and beliefs and convictions are all completely out, then we say, in the religious context, this is the person who knows. Now you see how utterly different this is from our ordinary everyday meaning of the word knowing. Because then there is the state of utter purity. And this, the all mind, transcendence, or whatever you like to call it, God or Brahman or Atma or the unborn, unbecome, unmade, etc., all functions freely through you. And when it functions freely through you like that, this reality which is transcendence will manifest through your psychophysical organism in all those ways which we name love, wisdom, truth, goodness, beauty, and so on. And those manifestations of love and wisdom and goodness will be outstandingly marked by the fact that there is no selfness displayed or involved, tied up in that manifestation. You see, it's a little bit like this. You see someone, he's a fine, upstanding fellow, most attractive and handsome, beautiful. Well, he just is like that. He doesn't try to be upstanding and healthy and beautiful and so forth. He just is like that. The essential isness, Ishtikkeit. Is that correct, Ruth? Eckhart's word, isn't it? The essential isness. And that is the reality of it. There's no selfness involved in it. I am not striving to be handsome and beautiful. And then beauty just manifests through that. So now, such something like this is of the nature of the religious consciousness, the religious mind, and religious living. Totally free of all selfness. And it's very, very hard to let that happen through one. And what a contrast that is to the worldly state, which is the state of turmoil, of drawing unto oneself. Brood on this. Let the mind be quiet. Let the whole psychophysical organism be quiet. And just look into this. Again, don't make a positive effort to look. Bring binoculars or telescopes or microscopes and throw searchlights because I've got to look. No. Just be quiet and it will speak unto you.